the most urgent issues that you're working on right now in Georgia? There's a lot that's going on. There are anti-immigrant bills. There's been an anti-Sharia effort. There's racial profiling. There's religious discrimination. There's work against immigrants and a lot more. So what is your main focus right now?
So fighting the anti-immigrant legislation, the anti-immigrant racial profiling legislation is definitely a high priority. There were a number of anti-immigrant bills introduced, including three versions of the Arizona copycat, Show Me Your Papers legislation, as well as a number of other bills, including a measure that would have banned undocumented students from enrollment at institutions of public higher education, and another measure that would have basically turned teachers and doctors into immigration officials by forcing them to, document and report data on number of undocumented students and patients. Thankfully, most of the measures have already died in one form or another. The measures that are still alive are two versions of the Arizona copycat bill. And obviously, we're fighting hard to ensure that Georgia doesn't enact a racial profiling piece of legislation.
Can you tell us what you're doing? So in your efforts working against that, what specifically are you doing? I know that you've put together this amazing coalition, the Georgia Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, that has a lot of different members. So can you talk about what you're doing at the ACLU, perhaps how you're working with other groups and then the coalition in terms of your efforts to work against these bills?
Right. So we've had we call them By the People Lobby Days already, and there's going to be another one coming up Tuesday, actually two focused specifically on immigrants' rights issues and one on racial profiling, anti-racial profiling. What the lobby days are, it's been an ACLU of Georgia tradition now for the past 7 years we invite community groups to come to the Capitol. We actually partner with community groups in offering the program. So the ACLU of Georgia provides lobby training, but it's really a means for people to come to the Capitol and to talk to their legislators. Every Tuesday, the ACLU of Georgia coordinates this program. So as I said, we've had two focused already on immigrants' rights issues and one more coming up and one on the anti-racial profiling measure that we were trying to advance. And then in addition to that, we've been having a number of, press conferences, one coordinated by one that was, highlighting the voices of the civil rights and human rights community. From the NAACP, from the Coalition for the People's Agenda, other groups speaking out against the racial profiling legislation. Then we had a press conference on the occasion of International Women's Day with the various women's rights and reproductive justice groups speaking out about the legislation and the impact on women. And then, most recently, yesterday, there was a huge rally at the Capitol that, drew about 9,000 people. That was, coordinated by one of the organizations in our coalition, the Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights, and co-sponsored by a number of groups. And so, the coalition has really provided a means for, better coordination of, activities really a very focused and coordinated campaign. Right now, the focus of the campaign is to get Governor Deal to commit to to vetoing the legislation if in fact it ends up on his desk. And so, you know, there's going to be a petition circulated, and, you know, other types of campaign materials.
So in this coalition, there are all kinds of different groups. You've got faith groups, you've got labor groups, there are civil rights groups, there are immigrant groups, and there are some business groups as well. So how did you bring all those different groups together, and what value do they bring? What sort of self-interest and value does the business community bring? How do you use them? How do you use faith leaders? Because not all these groups don't always work together side by side, but it is an amazing coalition.
Right. So, there are guiding principles for the coalition that are, the basic gist of it is that you have got to be committed to, advancing the human rights of immigrant and refugee communities. And, really the point of the coalition was to ensure that, you know, the various immigrant and refugee and, you know, faith and, you know, women's rights and, domestic violence advocacy organizations that were not working at, you know, cross purposes, rather were working jointly together. Because, you know, all of our various groups are very busy. You know, we don't all have the capacity to have, you know, a lobbyist at the Capitol at all times. And so, one of the points of the coalition was to, you know, really coordinate our efforts and to ensure that, we are pulling our resources together. And so, you know, we each bring, you know, different sort of strengths and different capacities to the table, and, you know, we speak with different voices on the issue. So, you know, for example, on, you know, one recent hearing, there were actually three hearings on the House Bill 87, which was, you know, the House version of the Arizona copycat measure. There were so many speakers that had, you know, testified, that had signed up to testify in opposition, and, all the testimonies were really powerful, and they were coming from different perspectives, you know, from the faith, from the business, from the, you know, from the Asian perspective, sort of, you know, testifying to the, you know, experience of, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act and the history of, you know, discrimination against Asian American communities, and how that community is horrified to see this play out again in another form. The collective of, you know, these different testimonies and experiences was really powerful, and I think that's really what, you know, makes the coalition a very very powerful coalition.
When all of these voices came and told these stories at the hearings and testified, did it have an impact? Did it make a difference to the legislators who were hearing them?
I think it really did. I mean, unfortunately, the bill did end up passing out of committee and out of the chamber, you know, partly because of the unfortunate, you know, composition of the legislature. At the end of the day, I think it must have made some of the legislators, you know, more reluctant at least to, to vote the way they did, or at least, you know, to pose additional questions to the author of the bill. The author of the bill had to have the language amended some, you know, about 26 or 27 times, just, you know, in response to all of the concern that was expressed and all of the questions that, you know, the committee members were posing to him as a result of the calls that they were, you know, receiving from the constituents. And the faith perspective is really powerful in Georgia. We had speakers, you know, quoting from the Bible. We had, you know, speakers. I remember, you know, this one teacher in particular who had got up at, you know, 4:30 a.m. For the third day in a row to ensure that he could be there to testify you know, because he was afraid of the impact of this legislation on the kids in his class and on their parents. And, you know, he was coming to this from the faith perspective, but also reminding the legislators that, you know, we are different from Arizona because we're the South. You know, we have a tradition of Southern hospitality and what has happened to that. And I think, you know, posing all of these questions to the legislators, to the author of the bill, to the members of the committee, you know, definitely made it more difficult for them to vote the wrong way, and they really had to go to great lengths to come up with, you know, a legitimate rationale for voting the way they did, which, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we don't believe that, you know, their rationale was, you know, legitimate at all.
So can you talk a bit about who that opposition is? So it sounds as if you did have some measurable success with the very powerful testimonies and people talking that the bill did have to get modified and that there were sharp questions again to the author of the bill. But it still went through. So who are... So is there public opposition? How strong is just the general public opposition to the work that you're doing? And then is that similar to or different than the organized political opposition of the legislators and the members?
Right. So, I mean, you know, I think, you know, actually at the rally yesterday, you know, when I gave a speech, I focused my speech, you know, at the rally, and the question that I posed to the legislators was, who is behind this legislation? Because obviously, you know, we've heard the teachers, we've heard we've heard from the faith community, the business community, you know, the immigrants, the, you know, the advocates. I mean, everyone, you know, has come out strongly in opposition to the bill. I should say, you know, at the hearings, there were actually two packed rooms because the room was relatively small. Not everybody could get in. So people were wearing, you know, in the packed rooms, you know, stickers saying, you know, immigrants are welcome here. And also the ACLU stickers saying, you know, Arizona, what happens in Arizona stops in Arizona. And all, you know, none of these people got the chance to speak. But, you know, there's definitely overwhelming opposition to these bills. To the extent that there is support, I think part of it is based on misinformation. You know, there's this organization called FAIR that has put out, you know, a study that's very misleading about the cost that undocumented immigrants pose to Georgia, and part of the cost that they have you know, taken into account is the education cost for U.S. citizen children of undocumented immigrants. And, you know, different organizations such as the Immigration Policy Institute who have put out sort of, you know, counter studies and also, you know, CAP showing that, you know, obviously, you know, immigrants boost economy, you know, with new businesses, and if immigrants actually, undocumented immigrants actually leave Georgia, that's going to be, you know, a huge economic disaster for Georgia. But again, unfortunately, you know, I think the misinformation has been sort of spreading really far and wide, and, you know, the legislators just, you know, keep citing to the FAIR study, and also there's an attempt to sort of, you know, scapegoat immigrants for sort of the economic woes of the state. And then, you know, as I said, the question that I posed was, you know, who is behind this legislation? Because in Arizona, the investigation that was done after the fact showed that it was actually the, you know, the private prison industry, the Corrections Corporation of America specifically, who had actually drafted the legislation. And that's, you know, a very troubling indication, you know, especially in Georgia, a state that has 4 immigration detention centers already. 2 of them are managed by CCA. 1 of them is the largest immigration detention center in the country. You know, it's, I mean, in recent years, you know, the state has seen a boom in, you know, the number of immigrants being detained. and, you know, detained in really horrible and inhumane conditions. And, you know, I think the legislators who are supporting this legislation really owe an answer to their constituents and to the people of Georgia. You know, what is the benefit of this legislation to the people of Georgia? And if, you know, in fact, there are, you know, private prison, you know, industry, the prison industry is supporting this legislation for obvious reasons, for, you know, the millions of dollars of, you know, in profit that they're making off the back of immigrants, then, you know, we need to have that answer. You know, they need to be transparent about that.
And so you'll keep pushing that question. That's an excellent question, actually. What's behind this legislation? Because you have so many people, so many different groups on your side. So who is behind it?
Yeah. And, you know, there are reporters, you know, as we speak, who are digging into that question. And we do hope that, you know, we have, some articles published, before the bill proceeds any further.
Right. I want to ask you a question about reality and rhetoric. One of the things you must see just on a daily basis is the big gap between the everyday reality of Muslim Americans in your community and immigrant communities, the discrimination they face, and just the reality of their lives versus the very harsh political rhetoric that's directed against them. Can you talk a bit about that difference and just bring to light some of the everyday realities?
Right. So, George, as I mentioned, there are, these immigration detention centers. Georgia also has four counties that have the 287G program in place. The ACLU of Georgia did a study on the impact of the 287G program on two of the counties, Cobb and Gwinnett. We showed that 287G in these counties has made a bad situation worse. I mean, you know, there is a troubling record of racial profiling and racial discrimination in law enforcement. Obviously our state, unfortunately, doesn't have the anti-racial profiling legislation on the books, which sort of left the door open for, you know, racial profiling. And then 287G has provided, local law enforcement with additional power to crack down on immigrant communities and communities of color. And so, you know, we showed that 287G has, you know, led to racial profiling, has really created an atmosphere of terror for immigrant communities and isolation, and far from making the community safer, it has actually led to less safe communities for all of us, because immigrants are afraid to talk to the police. And, you know, in one of our studies, a woman who's kitchen was on fire, was afraid to call 911 because of a bad experience she has had with the police one day on the way back from the park, a family outing to the park. And I think that's sort of the daily reality for immigrants in Cobb and Gwinnett who are afraid of any interaction whatsoever with the police because they have seen their community members being picked up, being placed in deportation, and not hearing from them again. And, you know, we have families being separated and with the sorts of proposals coming out of the state legislature, making life even more difficult for immigrants every day, I think the reality is really stark. In regards to the Muslim community, obviously, you know, there is discrimination on the ground and, unjustified governmental, surveillance You know, we do hear about community members being targeted by the FBI, you know, at the mosque, at their, you know, place of worship or business, you know, again, oftentimes for no reason whatsoever, just for the purpose of, you know, voluntary questioning. Sometimes these are, you know, in cooperation with local law enforcement. And there were also mosques in Georgia that wanted to expand, specifically a mosque in Lilburn. Unfortunately, the city council, you know, put up a barrier to the very legitimate request that the mosque had. And, you know, the really troubling factor of it for me personally was, you know, the mosque had been around for, you know, more than a decade, and the community had been around, obviously, and how, you know, this proposal and this mosque was being viewed as an outside force. In the headline that came out in the AJC, our, you know, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, right after, you know, the city council had voted against the mosque proposal, was that the community defeats the mosque, as if the mosque is, you know, this this foreign, you know, outsider. I mean, you know, we wrote to them, right, and, you know, they changed the headline. But that very much reflects on the reality lived by Muslim Americans, you know, everyday reality, being viewed as outsiders and, you know, not really being accepted as everyday Americans, you know, living their lives. And, you know, we've seen discrimination play out, you know, in other forms. You know, religious discrimination is very well, alive, as we saw, you know, in the case of Mrs. Valentine, the Muslim woman who is our client, who was denied entry to the courthouse when she was accompanying her nephew to a traffic hearing. And she was told that she had to take that off, that referring to her headscarf. And when she refused and said that, you know, this is my religious faith, I, you know, it's the expression of my religious faith, I can't do that. And the guard basically told her that she had to. And so Mrs. Valentine said, you know, there was some exchange of words, and she said, okay, I'm leaving. And she was, you know, what was going through her mind was the experience of two other Muslim women at the same, you know, at the same courthouse with the same judge being refused entry to the courthouse and told that they had to take their head covering off. And at this point, you know, basically she said, bullshit, I'm leaving. The guard said, no, you're not leaving. And, you know, they put handcuffs on her and, you know, brought her before the judge, who sentenced her to contempt of court. And she was made to remove her headscarf and, you know, was placed in a temporary holding facility and then transferred on a bus, chained to other prisoners to the jail, and was held there for, you know, a few hours before there was, you know, national outcry and she was released. And, you know, just the impact of this experience and, you know, feeling humiliated for the expression of her faith was just, you know, so so profound and, you know, disturbing for her and her family. And, you know, I don't think it's, you know, it's really not an anomaly.
In a situation like that, which is just so, you know, dramatic and inexcusable, and it's hard to believe in some ways. Are there allies among faith communities, Christian, Jewish faith communities in Georgia, who may have historic memories of discrimination and oppression against them, and who also feel very keenly the right to practice their religious freedom? So for a nun to wear a habit and be able to keep her habit on without, you know, going to jail. Are those allies?
Yeah, and, you know, I should say that, you know, the experience of Mrs. Valentine actually led to the establishment of a policy by the Georgia Judicial Council, because you know, she was courageous enough to go before the Supreme Court Commission on Fairness and Equal Access to the Courts. And, you know, she talked about her experience, and the judges on the Supreme Court Commission were really appalled that, you know, a colleague of theirs would subject, you know, any American to this experience. And so they recommended that a policy that the ACLU of Georgia had drafted be adopted by the Georgia Judicial Council. And the policy basically talks about, you know, all people of faith. And what it says is that, you know, headgear should be allowed in court, religious headgear, or, you know, if headgear is worn for medical reasons. And if there are concerns about security, you know, headgear can be searched so long as the person who searches it is, you know, same-sex officer and the person is allowed to put their headgear back on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, balancing, you know, a person's religious, you know, free exercise of religion with any security concerns that, you know, may be present. And you know, Mrs. Valentine, you know, when she brought the lawsuit, you know, throughout, she's been very keen on saying that, you know, this is really about, you know, ensuring that all people of faith are allowed, you know, the free exercise of religion. And I should say that, you know, other communities of faith, you know, have always been very supportive. For example, you know, ADL sent a letter to the Georgia Supreme Court Commission on Fairness and Equal Access to the Courts. And also, you know, when the, you know, the controversy around the Islamic Center in
mm-hmm.
New York was,
yes.
you know, breaking out back in September. Definitely, in the faith community in Atlanta, you know, was very supportive, and you know, all sort of unanimously, you know, spoke out together, sort of in, you know, in opposition to the attacks on the Muslim community.
That's great. I want to ask you about lessons you have learned that might be useful for people in other states, lessons in terms of community organizing, in terms of building an effective coalition, in terms of who your messengers are, what the messages are, who the messengers are, how you talk about these issues. Are there things that you've learned that people in other states would find useful in their work?
You know, I mean, I think working in the South, you know, poses its own particular challenges. You know, immigrant communities here are not as well established as, you know, communities elsewhere. Also working with, you know, Muslim communities, you know, has its own, you know, set of issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a
sure.
good reason, you know, communities are very cautious and, you know,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to cooperating with, you know, figures of authority such as, you know, the FBI. So, and partly because, you know, obviously, you know, many people have, you know, left countries where there has always been a dictatorship where, you know, you do what you're told unless, you know, you want to risk ending up in jail. So, I mean, oftentimes when, you know, for example, you know, we do a Know Your Rights presentation and say that, you know, you really, it's in your best interest not to talk to the FBI, you know, when there's like a voluntary questioning, and to, it is in your best interest to express and to assert your right to silence, you know, there is some doubt about why, you know,
mm-hmm.
why should we do that? And, but I think, you know, increasingly with, you know, the younger generation specifically, you know, people are more and more aware of their rights. And the same with, you know, the younger generation among, you know, the Latino communities, you know, specifically the Dreamers are, you know, definitely, you know, very much asserting themselves and, you know, standing up for their rights. You know, I also think that, you know, again, working in the South, you know, specifically in Georgia, I think, you know, it does present its sort of set of, you know, unique opportunities and perspective, because I'm in Georgia, obviously, you know, being the, you know, coming from the history of the civil rights struggle, you know, is very powerful. And, you know, obviously, you know, the civil rights community now, you know, being involved in the immigrants' rights movement and sort of, you know, drawing up on, you know, some of those experiences. But then again, you know, at the same time, because, you know, the immigrant community hasn't been, you know, as established here and hasn't been sort of interacting with, you know, all other communities, it, you know, it was challenging at first to try to, you know, build up these coalitions. But I think, you know, now, definitely, you know, people obviously, you know, appreciate the opportunity to, you know, to work together and to, you know, to learn from each other's experiences. And so yeah, I think, you know, I mean, coalition work can be challenging, but I think that the key is to be persistent, and to just keep at it, because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, that's how, you know, struggles can be won, I mean, through, you know, building, you know, broad coalitions.
So to switch for a minute from coalitions to individuals and to personal stories, can you tell us your own story?
Yeah. So I came to the U.S. when I was 16. Well, I guess, you know, my story from the very beginning. I was born 4 days after the Iranian Revolution. So, wow. You know, my name, Azadi means freedom. So that's where my name came from, because, you know, a lot of girls in my generation were named Azadi, sort of reflecting the hopes of our parents, you know, which unfortunately they were, you know, disillusioned later on. But, you know, I definitely, you know, grew up with, you know, the revolutionary spirit. But I think, you know, what when I came here, you know, when I was 16, you know, what really appealed to me was, you know, the free exercise of religion, which is obviously, you know, very much not the case in Iran. And just, you know, the beauty of just, you know, being free to, you know, express your belief, and not having, you know, a set of beliefs or a particular way of practicing your religion or not, you know, imposed upon you. So, you know, it is definitely a privilege to work with the ACLU to, you know, to stand up for this right. I am an immigrant. I came here when I was 16, and it was definitely, you know, difficult transition, you know, as a teenager the South.
Yeah.
I came to Memphis at first. But, you know, it's been, I very much, you know, value living in this country. And, you know, I mean, every time I look at the Bill of Rights, I'm, you know, just amazed by, you know, the scope and the strength of the language. And again, you know, being able to, you know, fight for these rights, you know, every day is really an honor. I should just, you know, mention briefly how I ended up, like, doing this work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you why you went to law school.
Yeah. So I actually, you know, I was, my parents very much wanted me to go to medical school as, you know, immigrant parents from the Middle East. And I was actually sort of, you know, in a program, you know, Michigan used to have this program called Interplex, where you applied in high school and a place was reserved for you in medical school. So that path had already kind of been determined for me. But then in college, I started taking different courses in humanities and being involved with, you know, human rights organizations. And I thought, you know, really, I mean, this is my life and I really want to do human rights work. So my senior year in college, I changed my mind and as a rebel, applied to law school. So the only place I applied to was Michigan, and, you know, I was lucky enough to get in. But, you know, I mean, I went to law school to do human rights work. And so, you know, after graduating from law school, my husband and I graduated at the same time, and he is an academic, so we had to go to, you know, where he had a job, and it was North Carolina. And you know, it was difficult at first because I didn't have any connections in North Carolina, and I really hadn't envisioned myself in, you know, not the South. I mean, I thought, right, you know, Geneva or, you know, or I don't know, D.C. or New York.
Sure. And,
but then, you know, I didn't expect to find such a large Muslim Middle Eastern community in North Carolina. And, then, you know, it was 2004, so it was, you know, at the height of the anti-Muslim crackdown. And so I was, you know, very much looking for an organization or, you know, project that was catering to the needs of the community, and I didn't find anything. So I approached the ACLU of North Carolina, and I proposed a project that would be focused on empowerment of the community in terms of, you know, your rights presentations and in terms of ensuring that the community had legal representation through, you know, training and recruiting a network of attorneys, and then also started a campaign against racial profiling, bringing together, you know, different communities, African-American communities and Latino and, you know, Muslim and Middle Eastern and South Asian communities. And then I moved to Georgia, and, you know, luckily enough, I was able to stay with the ACLU, and I was able to start my own project. So I've been doing this work in Georgia since March of 2008, so for about 3 years now, and it's been really fantastic. I mean, you know, it really is great to be excited about the work that you do. So, so yeah, and I think, you know, what's really, what I also really like about this work is, you know, I am an attorney, but we don't have a sort of, you know, single strategy focus. So, you know, we view litigation as a tool in our toolbox. And, you know, our work is very much multi, you know, multi-pronged. And, you know, we adopt and, you know, make use of various strategies. And if it so happens that litigation, you know, is the strategy that's going to, you know, advance the cause, then that's, you know, that's what needs to happen. But, you know, we very much work, you know, in coalition and, you know, working towards, you know, building a movement.
Mm-hmm. So you're right. It is important work, and we're lucky that you're doing it. So my last question for you is, when you look ahead in the coming days, what is it that concerns you most? And then what is it that gives you hope?
You know, what gives me hope is really the people of Georgia. I mean, they've just, I mean, yesterday being at the rally, you know, with 9,000 people, I mean, I was just so proud to be part of this crowd. And people who have just come out in support, you know, I mean, all of these people, I mean, there's just been such an you know, outburst of support for immigrant communities and in solidarity with immigrant communities, and people finally realizing that this is outrageous and this is not what Georgia is about, you know. So, yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, standing up for, you know, human rights of other communities, I think that is really important. And also, I mean, we saw the same with, you know, when the mosque was under attack in Lilburn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely, you know, I mean, the local community was under attack. So, you know, different communities organized, and, you know, we all went there to show support. So, so yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, very strong element of, you know, solidarity among communities in Georgia. And, you know, what gives me concern is, you know, Latino communities and Muslim communities in particular now, there seems to be, like, in an open season. So, mm-hmm. you know, politicians, media, you know, there just doesn't seem to be any element of restraint in terms of the different proposals, the different ways to discriminate. And I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, when you talk about immigrants' rights issues now, you know, the most effective argument is how this bill is going to affect the business, you know, interest and
right.
how,
mm-hmm.
you know, the economy. And they always tell us, you know, don't talk about human rights and don't talk about racial profiling. And that is really outrageous. I mean, are we saying that? And, you know, I mean, I do understand, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we want to be effective in our arguments. And, you know, obviously, and obviously, immigrants are very important to the economy of Georgia. But at the end of the day, we are talking about human beings. So are we saying that, you know, somehow, you know, Muslim Americans and Latinos and, you know, different brown-skinned people are not, you know, they're not worth,
right,
you know, they're
right.
human, they don't have the human dignity, and that's why we don't need to focus on them as human beings and need to talk about, you know, all of these other, you know, interests. And so that is really worrisome, and, you know, I hope that, you know, people who haven't woken up yet and haven't realized that, you know, there are interests out there, you know, the corporate interests that are sort of, you know, taking advantage of and, you know, making a scapegoat of immigrants, that people, you know, wake up and realize that, so...
Well, I think, you know, given your efforts and the coalition's efforts and the efforts of others and the Know Your Rights rallies, you're having more and more people are waking up to realize that. So thank you very much for the work that you do, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.